Hello, Anthony Fennell here. This is Future Tense and part two of our look at forests and forest-related issues. In today's show, we'll hear more about the rights of Indigenous forest dwellers and why their stewardship of trees should be protected. We'll also talk remote sensing and spatial forest data with the University of Queensland's Dr. Peter Scarth. We'll find out about an Austrian-led initiative to map and monitor the world's remaining forest stocks. And Swedish scientist Erik Westholm will tell us about the peculiar and particular climate change challenge faced by boreal forests in the very north of Europe.
Climate change is expected to increase forest growth in Sweden because we get warmer and wetter, more rainfall. So in the short term, it's possible to interpret these changes as positive.
You're on RN and this is Future Tense with Anthony Fennell. Also available online and via iTunes. Our Twitter name is RN Future Tense, all one word, and we broadcast across the Asia Pacific region via Radio Australia.
Now, last week's episode concerned a UN project called RED, Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation. It's a scheme currently being trialled, and it's designed to give forests an economic value that will make it more attractive for governments and companies to preserve trees rather than cut them down. If you missed it, you can always podcast it or stream it from our website. Anyway, one of our guests on that show was William Sunderland, a scientist with the organisation C4, the Centre for International Forestry Research. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
What we are aiming to do in our research is to measure the performance of RED on a number of criteria, on its carbon effectiveness, its cost efficiency, the equity of the distribution of benefits, and the extent to which it's fulfilling a range of co-benefits, including poverty reduction and protection of rights and biodiversity protection.
That notion that protecting the world's forests isn't just about saving trees, but about poverty reduction and the protection of community rights, speaks to the fact that some of the best preserved forests in the world are those where local communities or forest dwellers have stewardship, not just governments or companies.
My name's Jenny Springer, and I'm Director of Global Programs with the Rights and Resources Initiative.
We spoke with Jenny in our last episode about the RED scheme specifically, but we thought it might be a good idea to hear a bit more about her organisation, its aims, and why she believes the future of forests is so directly tied to community rights.
The Rights and Resources Initiative is a global coalition. We focus on securing land and resource rights of Indigenous peoples and local communities, especially in forest areas, and the ability of communities to benefit from natural resources. We exist because we see that in the global context and among a wide range of organizations that are seeking to generate solutions to the key environmental and economic development issues facing the planet, that when the organization was founded, that there was a very critical missing piece, which was that the situation of communities who have customary collective rights to land was not getting sufficient attention. And so the priority was to bring together a wide range, a wide diversity of different types of organizations. Indigenous organizations, community organizations, researchers, NGOs, and others who shared a common concern with that issue and wanted to raise the visibility of the need for recognition of community land and resource rights, and also support the actors in country who were seeking to secure that recognition more effectively. I think one of the things that we see more recently is that through the efforts of many organizations, many groups, the issues have become more visible, and yet there's still a long way to go in terms of effective implementation on the ground.
Can I get you to give us a percentage of the amount of forest area in the world that currently has some kind of stewardship from Indigenous people or local communities?
The estimate that's been made of the area of land globally that is under customary community tenure, so that encompasses forest lands as well as other community-managed lands like rangelands, is over 6.6 billion hectares of land. So that's over half the world's land area. Now, that's a rough estimate. And then focusing in to the forest area, there are not actually at this point very good estimates globally within that 6.6 billion hectares of the area that's forest. But we do know from our work that the area of global forest where there's legal recognition of indigenous and community tenure is about 15.5% of the world's forests.
And your organization argues, doesn't it, that indigenous ownership or stewardship of forests is a way of protecting forests from deforestation and a very effective way of protecting forests from deforestation.
That's exactly right. We see that securing community land rights and management are key solutions to global environmental problems like deforestation and climate change. And looking specifically at the role of communities in managing forests, there's a large amount of evidence that shows that where local people have secure rights to their lands and support to manage them effectively, the environmental outcomes are very good. In a number of well-documented cases, they're actually better than under other types of governance. Looking at the situation of the Brazilian Amazon, the largest, most important area of forests on the planet, the forest loss between 2000 and 2012 in the Brazilian Amazon was only 0.6% inside legally recognized indigenous lands, compared with 7% outside indigenous lands.
Why is that? Why is there such a difference?
For a number of reasons. One is that historically, many communities have developed ways of managing their lands and natural resources that are appropriate to their local environments. This is people's way of life. It's their cultural heritage. So they work to conserve their resources and their lands for their future generations. It's the basis for their cultures and way of life. But unfortunately, where communities don't have legal rights and they don't have support for protection of their lands, they tend to face a lot of problems that interfere with their environmental management. People have often been displaced, physically displaced. And then we also find that customary lands are often overlapped by other land uses like natural resource concessions, you know, mining, other types of industrial activities. And even where people remain on their lands, there's a high level of insecurity that inhibits long-term investment. So this is why we stress the importance of having legal recognition and support that enables the operation of customary tenure and management systems and local institutions to be effective.
Now, a lot of those local communities and a lot of those indigenous peoples, they often tend to be quite poor. What does that mean in terms of their ability to enact change or to resist the type of change that might come from corrupt governments, say, or organizations that are intent on exploitation?
Yes, that has been a huge problem for many communities. I think one of the ways that indigenous peoples and other community groups have sought to address these power imbalances is by organizing effectively. And so globally, you do see the growth of local to national indigenous peoples organizations and federations that are then in a better position to negotiate and bring their claim, their legitimate claims to governments. Also, I think there's been progress over time in the establishment of alliances among different types of constituencies with shared interests, and so that many indigenous peoples and organizations have been able to build alliances with other kinds of civil society groups with interests that align with theirs.
But as is evidenced by the existence of your organization, this is an ongoing problem, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. In fact, as we've studied the legal recognition of forest tenure, we found actually that it has slowed down in the period of time that we've studied. We looked at, you know, what had happened from 2002 into 2013 and found that starting around 2008, there was a slowdown in the pace of recognition. So it was still increasing overall, but and much more slowly. And this was particularly the case in terms of recognition of ownership, rights of indigenous peoples and local communities to own forest lands.
And why do you believe there has been that slowdown, given that, I guess you could say, in some ways, the issue has been much more visible in the last couple of years?
Yes, that's true. At the same time, the competing pressures on land have grown. So we have seen that there is a global rise in demand for various types of land-based commodities, for land itself, for agribusiness concessions, for mining, other types of industrial pressures on land.
And looking ahead, how optimistic are you about developments, given, as you said, there seems to be a bit of a downturn over recent years?
We have seen a slowdown in the recognition of rights. At the same time, there are a number of important countries where advances are being made. In the case of Indonesia, for many years, rights were relatively weakly recognized. Indigenous peoples, it's estimated, have customary rights to at least 40 to 50 million hectares of forest in Indonesia. And while those rights are protected under the Constitution, the national forest law, for example, said that those lands were the property of the state. The Constitutional Court decided a couple of years ago that that was unconstitutional. And now there's an active process underway that's being led by Indigenous peoples organizations in Indonesia to map and register their customary lands. And the new president of Indonesia has committed to support legislative processes that would recognize Indigenous rights.
Jenny Springer, the Director of Global Programs at the Rights and Resources Initiative, headquartered in Washington. If you were walking through the forests of Tasmania recently, you might have come across one of these. Drones can be an environmental pest, if you don't mind me saying so, but some of them are being put to good intent, even in the deepest, darkest parts of Tassie. Dr. Peter Scarth is from the University of Queensland's Centre for Remote Sensing and Spatial Information Services, and he's been part of a research team putting different types of technology to work to help us get a better understanding of how forests work. Peter Scarth.
Well, we've been working in Tasmania. It's one of our field sites. We've got a number across Australia, but Tasmania has been the tallest forest that we've been working in. And down there, we've been using a mixture of drones and terrestrial laser scanning, along with traditional forestry techniques, to, I suppose, better understand the processes that are going on within the forest.
And you've been using that technology to, as I understand, capture a 3D vision of the forest that can be monitored then over time. Is that correct?
The drones give you a synoptic view, but you can also use the imagery that you get from a drone to build a three-dimensional model of the forest. The laser scanning sits on the ground of the forest floor, but it builds up a three-dimensional model of the forest as well, with a much higher resolution.
So you get quite a comprehensive picture, quite a detailed picture of the forest at a given time.
That's right. So you get to see position and the location of all the trees, you get to see the position and the location of all the leaves, and you get to see the spacing and how the whole forest canopy, I guess, works. You also get information on the understory, so the shrubs that are growing up underneath the forest as well. And the beauty of the technology, I suppose, is it's all captured digitally. So you get a snapshot of the forest, which gives you much more information than a photograph ever would. And you can store that and come back to that in 5 or 10 years' time down the track and just see what the changes have been in the forest.
And the specific benefits of having that much detail?
There's a number of benefits. Maybe I'll step back and go to traditional forestry measures, where you walk out there with a tape measure and you might measure the size of each tree. That gives you quite good information on the size of the tree, and you can measure that over time and see how a tree grows. And you can also measure, for example, the amount of cover, so the amount of leaf cover that's overhead. And they're kind of the two big forestry measures that are used over time. With a laser scanner, you get that detail, but you get that detail, for example, of the size of the tree all the way up into the canopy, so you get to see the taper of the tree. Once you get into the canopy, you get to see the branching structure, the angles of where the branches go, and where the leaves are sitting and the angle of those leaves. And that gives you a lot more information about what's happening in the canopy and the processes that are going on there.
So there is a significant benefit in using this type of technology over, say, traditional field observation.
There is, because you get a higher level of detail, and in many ways it's more reproducible than traditional field survey. So you've got an instrument which is calibrated back to a laboratory standard, and you would expect if you place that instrument in the same position the following day, you would get the same amount of information out of it, exactly the same level of detail. With traditional survey methods, a tape measure is pretty accurate and they're quite good, but anything to do with visual observations where people look at a photo standard and then interpret what they're seeing are subject to change over time. And we're trying to get rid of that bias in the measurements.
And what's the benefit or what's the need for this type of long-term monitoring in a forest like the World Heritage Forest in Tasmania that you've been working in?
Well, the forest that we've been working in down there is a mixed World Heritage and production forest, so it's an interesting case. But what we're really looking at there is the effect of, I suppose, longer-term changes in the environment around it. So that could be due to changes in rainfall, changes due to temperature changes, any sort of climatic changes over time. The processes that are involved in those types of changes and the effect of the forest are very slight, and so you need an instrument with the precision that's able to pick up those very slight changes if you want to actually measure them, you know, over a period of maybe a couple of years. Traditional forestry methods will pick up changes in structure over a 10-year period, but often you want to, you know, start picking up changes sooner than that.
And you're sharing this data, aren't you?
That's right. So we make all the data that we collect freely available on our TERN AusCover servers, and they're open to researchers and the public, you know, across Australia and across the world.
Do you see this type of high-tech approach playing a bigger role in the future of forestry management more broadly across the world?
I think so. I think there's broad interest in laser scanning and in drones. The price of these instruments are going down over time, and the ability to use them and the technology is becoming easier to use. So there's a lot of interest across the world and in developing countries who want to start looking at their carbon resource to go out with these sort of tools and collect data which then can be uploaded and processed and used globally. I mean, we're already seeing the development in drone technology where you can buy a, you know, quite a cheap drone which will follow you as you walk across a bridge or snowboard down a slope, and the drones themselves are becoming much easier to fly. The limiting issue with drones is primarily with the Civil Aviation Safety Authority and actually flying them safely and within guidelines, and also with the battery life. So still looking at only 20 minutes or so of battery life on drones. With laser scanning, the price of those is dropping dramatically as well. The instrument that we use, when we bought it, cost around $170,000. It's a high-end instrument, and some of the research instruments by CSIRO cost, you know, several times more than that. But just last week, we were out in the field with a $5,000 instrument, which is collecting pretty good data as well. And those sort of instruments are going to increase in precision over time, and the cost will probably remain the same.
So this technology is good for monitoring developments in specific forests, but because it's freely shared, is it likely to add to our combined knowledge about larger ecosystems or larger regions?
Oh, absolutely. So there's traditional forestry measurements where you're looking at, you know, tree volume and height and cover and those sorts of things, but more and more people are using these types of data sets to understand biodiversity, to understand, you know, specific ecological niche habitats, and to, I suppose, understand the processes that are happening on the forest floor. So look at the amount of fallen logs for fire and fuel load assessment, and a whole range of other activities that we probably haven't thought of yet. The actual making of data available, so the opening up of the data set to researchers, I guess enables a lot more applications to be developed rather than just, you know, holding onto them for one particular purpose.
Well, Dr. Peter Scarth from the Centre for Remote Sensing and Spatial Information Science at the University of Queensland, thank you very much for joining us on Future Tense.
Thank you.
From an Australian involved in mapping forests to an Austrian now who's doing things on a very large scale indeed. Stefan Fritz is with the Earth Observation Systems Group at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Vienna. And he and his colleagues and around 5,000 volunteers have been busy using satellite imagery and other data sources to make better world maps. Highly accurate maps that can be utilised by environmental groups, governments and international organisations to show the true extent of the world's forest reserves and the threats they face.
So the value of our maps is that we use existing maps, we use the best global maps which we can find on, for example, forests, and then we use citizen science to tell us which map is correct at which location. So we are creating a new so-called hybrid map based on the best existing maps and increase the accuracy of that map using citizen science.
And the citizen scientists that you use, some of them are lay people, some of them have expertise in the area. What do they bring, though, to this project?
So basically, we ask them to look at Google Earth type of very high resolution images and tell us if they can see, for example, forest or not. we then can use this data and use it for calibration of our maps. So we use this as so-called training data, or also potentially for validation data, which means that we can tell the accuracy of our new produced map and know how good it is compared to other global existing maps. And we found that by using this information, we produce higher level, better quality maps. So mostly so far, we got a big response by students. One incentive we used was co-authorship on papers we have produced. And the biggest motivation for students is to become co-authors on the paper. So they were those who participated most. And that was also the data which was most reliable.
Now, this project actually involves two global forest maps, doesn't it? Tell us the difference between those two maps.
So one map is the best guess map, which means that we think that in some countries, the maps and the data produced by the Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN is not very accurate. And therefore, we do a best map. But at the same time, we make a second map, which uses this official Food and Agricultural Organization-based data and calibrate that. So one map is consistent with FAO, Food and Agricultural Organization statistics, and the other one is independent.
How much of the world's forests have you managed to map?
So we produced a new global forest map. So it's the whole world, the forest of the whole world. And of course, when you do such a big endeavor, there are uncertainties at certain places. But it's the best map currently on a 1 kilometer resolution in terms of percentage forest cover found.
Stefan Fritz there from the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Vienna, making maps and getting citizen scientists involved in the process. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Think forests, and I'm sure for most of us that means Asia or South America. But the boreal forests of the Northern Hemisphere are no less important. The forests cover large tracts of Northern Europe, Canada, Russia, and even parts of Japan, land that's often cold and inhospitable. Boreal forests are often not natural, in the sense that we think of virgin forests. They've been altered significantly by human activity over time. Like tropical forests, they too are being affected by climate change, but we rarely hear them mentioned in that regard. Professor Erik Westholm is with the Department of Urban and Rural Development at the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences, and he's an expert on boreal, or as they're sometimes called, Nordic forests. Just a few months ago, at an international forestry conference, he launched a provocative book called The Future of Nordic Forests, which he intended as a wake-up call to his home country, Sweden, to get Swedes thinking anew about the future of their forests and not simply taking them for granted. Erik Westholm.
The Swedish forest companies started to export in Europe and across the world 100 years ago. So the boreal forests have been provided the bulk of the world market for forest products. And Sweden, a small country in the north, with quite a good forest growth because of the Gulf Stream which comes to us. It's a country which is covered to 50% by forest. Productive forest land is 50% of the total land cover. So the forest industry is fundamental to the Swedish economy and has been driving our welfare state project, I would say. It has had a major role in that.
So the boreal forests, the Nordic forests, are interesting, aren't they? Different than a lot of the other forests that we talk about because of that production role that they also fulfill. So there's a balance there, isn't there, between production and also environmental concerns?
Oh, yes, it is. And we have a national forest policy which states that production and biodiversity should be paid equal value in forest management. But also we have a great freedom for the forest owners to take those decisions on the ground, the trade-offs between production and biodiversity interests. And there are also a number of other interests in the boreal forest. It's about outdoor recreation, aesthetic values, landscape aspects, etc. So there are many interests in relation to the forest. And we also have a general access to the forest, so anyone can go there and pick mushrooms and berries and use the forest. And so they are deeply embedded in social and economic and cultural rural Sweden, I would say.
We often hear discussion about the tropical rainforests of the world and threats to them, but we rarely hear discussion about the welfare or the well-being of Nordic forests. Why is that, do you think?
Well, the situation is very different because our forest cover and our forest growth is increasing all the time. And we have a situation where it's mandatory to replant if you lumber an area. So there is actually, ideally at least, forest growth on every hectare. There is not a deforestation problem. There is a problem, a serious problem about diminishing biodiversity, and there is a heavy debate on whether we should go for intensification and more plantation-like forest management, or and the value of biodiversity and all the other values. Also, hunting is a big issue here in the forest. But I think that is a kind of a game shift going on, because what we need is a very different forest debate than the one we ever had. Since 1850 or something, the forest industry has been driving all the time for increased forest production. But the scene is now much more complex. Other issues are coming in. The climate change is a major one, and it's very differently interpreted by various actors.
In fact, one of the really unusual complications is the reality that many people in Sweden and other northern regions see climate change, and specifically global warming, not as a threat, but as a potential future benefit. Eric Westholm again.
Climate change is expected to increase forest growth in Sweden because we get warmer and wetter, more rainfall. So in the short term, it's possible to interpret these changes as positive. So we have some people arguing for intensified forest production, both because forests mitigate carbon. So this is a kind of an ecosystem service coming in, because we can increase our export values. Others, of course, look at climate change as a serious threat in many ways, also to the Nordic forestry in the long run, with maybe more storms, insects, etc., all the traditional threats that is connected to climate change. Well, what we see when we study the various perceptions and strategies among key actors in relation to forestry is that they interpret these new global drivers and the new agenda very differently. And it drives the traditional forest community in Sweden in various directions. So the agenda today is much more complex in the trade-off between productivism and environmentalism, because it always was the environmental NGOs and so trying to preserve as much forest as possible. And that's maybe not the most important objective now, but to find the ways to manage forests, so the general management of the big forests, so that we can keep the biodiversity or increase the biodiversity.
Expanding forests as a potential environmental problem. Who'd have thought? Eric Westholm in Sweden. We also heard today from Stefan Fritz in Austria, Jenny Springer in the United States, Peter Scarth in Australia, and William Sunderland in Indonesia. Thanks to my co-producer, Karin Savanovitz, and to sound technician, Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
Hi, Fran Kelly here. Start your day with RM Breakfast, weekdays from 6.
And bookend your day with me, Patricia Carvalis, on RN Drive at 6 p.m.
But you can have breakfast anytime you like.
And you can drive anytime you like too.
Have breakfast in Drive and drive in breakfast with ABC Radio online and the ABC Radio app. Hear now, hear later, hear anywhere, hear here. Download the ABC Radio app now.
I love all day breakfast.